Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show was originally broadcast on Sunday, August 7th, 2011, on the Premier Radio Networks. This is episode 794. Enjoy! The Tech Guy Podcast is brought to you by Gazelle, the easy way to sell or recycle the used gadgets lying around your home or office. Don't just sell it, Gazelle it. For a 5% bonus payment for your used gadgets, go to gazelle.com and use the offer code TWIT. Well, a good day to you. How are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. And it's time to talk about, well, tech, computers, the internet, cell phones, camcorders, MP3 players, home theater, and all that jazz, as we do each and every weekend at this time. If you want to ask a question, I was talking about this on the last show, and I want to reiterate it today. Sometimes we geeks, and I apologize, forget that the vast majority of people are not geeks. And in fact, when we talk about stuff, even stuff that geeks consider just, you know, the hot and cold running water of the internet, things like Facebook and Twitter, that the majority of people go, I don't know what that is, I don't do it, I don't have anything to do with it. And we just assume that this is, oh, you all know about that, right? So I think on this show today, and I think probably going forward, I really want to emphasize the fact that everybody is welcome here. You don't have to be a geek, and I especially welcome those people who are here out of curiosity, who want to know more about technology, more about the internet, more about home theater or cell phones. And I want to assure you there are no dumb questions. There are, you know, that I know what it's like to be a beginner in a field, and I understand, and we'll try not to use jargon. We'll try to make this as accessible to everybody as possible. But I just want to encourage you, if you've got a question, first question on the last show was, what is Wi-Fi? I hear about Wi-Fi. I love that. Let's get more of that. 88 Ask Leo. That's the number if you'd like to call in and ask that question. And you know, if you're asking it, that the vast radio audience is probably saying, thank you for finally asking that question. I didn't have the nerve to do it. Thank you. 888-827-5536. That's the number to call. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. Outside the U.S., you can call the same number, but use Skype out or some VoIP solution that'll make it free for you to call. Because it's a toll free number in the U.S. 1-888-827-5536. Yesterday, I didn't acknowledge it. I should have acknowledged it. Was the 20th anniversary of the first public appearance of the World Wide Web. Wow. The World Wide Web is only 20 years old. Now, the internet is older, and, you know, sometimes people conflate the World Wide Web with the internet. That's not the same. So a little background here, maybe make it easier for you to understand. The World Wide Web is a protocol. Protocol means just rules of engagement, how we talk together. It's a protocol that describes how a computer on a network can talk to another computer on the network and request information. That's all the World Wide Web is. And it uses a language called HTML, Hypertext Markup Language. Which is really, markup language is the key word. It takes text and puts marks around it to say, this is bold, this is italic, this, and this is the most important one, is a link to another page. Another page that may not even be in this same computer. It might be on another computer out there over the network. That's what the World Wide Web, that's the basis of the World Wide Web is links. You can click a link and go there. Click a link, go there. It was created by a physicist named Tim Berners-Lee, who's still very active He's around. He runs the World Wide Web Consortium, which is a group that's aimed at kind of keeping the World Wide Web accessible, open, free, to have standards that any company or any individual can use, the HTML standards. So he's very active. He was a physicist at the time at the CERN Research Labs, C-E-R-N Research Labs, in Geneva, Switzerland. And actually, he created the World Wide Web, as usual in technology. The best stuff is created by somebody who wants to scratch their own itch, who has a problem, a need that they want to solve. They're not trying to find somebody else's problems. They're solving their own. And he's a programmer. He was a computer scientist as well as a physicist. And he wanted an easy way to share his physics research, his papers, with other physicists in a way that he could annotate it, they could annotate it, they could mark it up. Something really more like what we call a wiki today. But in order to do that, he had to create the World Wide Web. He built it on Next Machines. That was Steve Jobs' company. In between founding Apple, leaving Apple, and starting back at Apple, Steve had a company called Next. And those Next Machines were beautiful boxes. And that's what the first World Wide Web software was written on. The Internet goes back many, 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 many more years. It was actually a creation of the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA. And it was a way of... The Internet was created as a way for computers, of different kinds of computers, to talk to each other. Once they were talking to each other over this network, then we had other protocols, ways of communicating, like the chat protocol that we use today in our chat room, IRC, like Gopher, Archie. These are now long lost protocols. There were lots of different ways of communicating over the Internet. But when the web came along in 1991, it's hard to believe that's all. 1991, it was so easy for people to use that it really was a revolution. It changed everything. And the original web browser was a text browser that Sir Tim Berners-Lee created. There was a follow-up called Lynx. Many of you may have, some of you, I have used it many, many moons ago. There was, after Lynx, a kid at NCSA, the National Supercomputing, what was this, the A stand for? I don't remember. Agency at the University of Illinois, Urbana. A kid named Mark Andreessen wrote a little program that he called Mosaic, that added graphics, because the first web didn't have pictures. It didn't have graphics. It was just text. Mosaic then became Netscape when Andreessen left and started his own company. And then the rest is history, of course. After Netscape was Internet Explorer, then the Mozilla Foundation, then Firefox, Google comes along, Yahoo comes along, and the world changes. 20 years old yesterday, the World Wide Web. That's kind of an amazing fact. I mean, that's not old at all. One of the newest technologies we use every day, and yet it really did change our lives, didn't it? It really changed everything. Let's see, what else is going on in the news? I talked yesterday about this, but I'll mention it again. You probably heard on CNN and the BBC and many news outlets this bogus report that Internet Explorer users are dumber than the rest of the world. It was a joke. It was a hoax that fooled so many news organizations, including the august BBC, that they all had to issue retractions. The research was put out by, it said in the story, a Canadian firm. It wasn't a firm. It was some guy. They should have known. If they'd checked, they would have seen he created the website a month ago. And if you just use your noggin, it doesn't make any sense, does it, that somebody who uses a particular web browser would somehow be dumber than somebody who used... You know why everybody reported on it? Because it was such a funny thing to say, such a funny story. As somebody in the chat room said, you could say, neener, neener, neener. You are dumber. And this is actually what I want to combat, is that feeling among geeks that somehow people who use product X are somehow superior to people who use product Y, or people who understand this are better than people who understand that, or You know, there is that notion, isn't there, that, oh, I'm a Mac user, I'm better. Oh, I'm a Windows user, I'm better. No. You're all welcome to this big tent. 8888 Ask Leo. Let's talk. You and me. No judgment. I am Leo LaPorte, the tech guy. Hey, we're going to go back to the tech guy in just a moment. But before we do, I'd want to say hello to one of our podcast sponsors. Now, perhaps you've been listening to the podcast for a while and you said, what are you talking about? Well, we couldn't do ads in the podcasts for the first 7 years. But I recently renegotiated with our good friends at the Premier Radio Networks. And they said, well, yeah, put ads in there. So, okay, thank you. Because we've been doing this basically pro bono for a long, long time. And it'd be nice because we have to add editors and staff and build a studio and all that stuff to make a little extra money on the show and on the podcast. So here you go. Here you go. Let's talk a little bit about Gazelle. This is an ad I love to do because Gazelle really is good for everybody. It's a win-win-win. We all have used gadgets lying around. You've got that closet or that drawer. I have a drawer under my bed that's full of junk. Old MP3 players, GPSs, cell phones, PDAs, e-readers, Blu-ray players, calculators, camcorders, camera lenses, and now I can get money for it. Yes, at Gazelle.com. Gazelle's the easy way to sell or recycle your used gadgets. So all you do is go to Gazelle.com, and then you can just type in the name. You know, I got that Nokia N8. I just don't use it anymore. So let's search for that. And then they ask you some questions. Is it any functional problems? No. Normal wear and tear? No, actually, it looks like it's never been used because it never has. I have all the stuff. Paid a lot of money for that thing. I'd love to get some money back. Notice the price graph. I love that. Plummeting. They're smart. They know. Let's see. What am I going to get? Oh, $110. Look, I'll take it. I'll take it. So now you see the button, add to box. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to get a box and I'm going to throw all my gadgets lying around into that box. Now, some of them, admittedly, aren't going to be working anymore. Let's pick something. I got an external hard drive. It was a Seagate. This is fun. It was that Free Agent Go. Right. Yeah, that was great. Right there. It was 250 gigs. I'm going to sell that. Now, here's the problem. See, it doesn't work. Oh. Now, what they're going to say is, you can't give you anything for that, but you can recycle it. And they do, by the way, green recycling. Nothing, zero goes into the landfill. By the way, if there's data on it, they wipe it. They get rid of it. Kindles and Nooks and other ebook readers worth about $100. iPhones, as much as $200. MacBooks, $600. Make sure you put that correct model in there, the correct condition. They will recycle it, or they will clear the data, or they will give you money, or all three. Well, I guess they can't give you money and recycle it. And by the way, you choose the payment model you want. You can get PayPal, you can get a check, you can get an Amazon or Walmart gift card. If you do an Amazon gift card, you get a 5% bonus, and I'm going to give you an additional 5% bonus. Just use the offer code TWIT on checkout. Now you're getting some money. Get an Amazon gift card. And use the offer code TWIT. That's going to add up 10%. I love Gazelle. They've been around since 2006. They have a gadget lab team that not only inspects them, but also are their data experts. They'll remove all your personal data. It's a really great service, and I'm happy to tell you all about them. We know many people have used them. I've used them myself. Gazelle. Don't sell it. Gazelle it. Gazelle.com. Use the offer code TWIT on checkout to save 5%. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the number. Mike, the first caller of the day, Chula Vista, California. Hi, Mike. Leo, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo.
How are you?
I like your new studio, your new sets there.
Thank you. We're still working on it. You know, we built a very nice new studio, the Brick House Studios, to house not only the radio show, but all the other shows that I do. Because we do about 20 different shows all week long. And but the funny thing is, I tried to recreate my old Tech Guy Labs as inside. It's kind of almost in glass inside the new studio. And this is the last thing to be finished. So we still have a lot more work. It's a little dark and gloomy in here, but we'll get it. We'll get it. But I'm glad you watch. You can, if you're curious what it looks like, folks, you can go to the Tech Guy Labs website, and there's a link there, techguylabs.com.
I think you have way too much fun there.
Yeah, if you ever watch, we have a spy cam that we put up originally for people to watch watch us as we built it, and we've left it in because there's still so much to see. For instance, now we're putting up the brick wall of honor. People donated quite generously to help build this, and they all have bricks, and we're putting that in right now. So we have a spy cam on that. It's fun.
Yeah, I'm watching that. Yeah.
Yeah, you can see all the fun we have. So what can I do for you, Mike?
Well, I use voice memo for recording lectures on my iPod. And I like it because it's pretty good quality.
Voice, I'm not familiar with that. Voice memo.
Voice memo. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's on the iPhone and also the iPod Touch. It's an audio voice recorder.
Got it. I'm looking at it right now. I looked it up.
Anyway, I have problems transferring the file from my iPod to iTunes. I'm using Windows.
Yeah, welcome to the wild world of Apple. Apple, in its infinite wisdom, decided that file systems were too complicated for humans. So they eliminated them. They actually didn't eliminate them because computers still need a file system. What do I mean by a file system? Well, it's the what you use on a desktop computer to browse through the documents on your computer, the applications, all those files. They're displayed in a window using the file system. But you can't do that, can you, on an iPhone, an iPod, or a iPad? There is a file system, but Apple has decided it's not for you. Stay away. No looky. So the problem is that people are still creating files. When you use Voice Memo, you're creating a file. A file you can see in Voice Memo, and that's nice. That's all well and good. But it becomes an issue when you say, but I want access to that file outside of the iPod Touch.
Well, anyway, I'm thinking I'm getting just a dedicated audio recorder. Is there some that you can recommend that are good quality?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Olympus makes the best.
Olympus.
And, yeah, you want... Now, there are some Olympuses that have USB cables or they have memory in them. They're very small. They're very compact, which is nice. The key is that you can get them out of them into the computer, right? So that's what you're looking for. I don't have a model number off the top of my head. I'm just looking through my files here because Olympus sent me... They have a new one that's really designed for computers, and I just can't find the email. But if you go, any office store, Staples, Office Depot, all of them have the little Olympus pocket recorders. They're very small. And now, what are you recording notes to yourself? What are you recording?
Oh, the actual lectures in the class.
Ah, okay. That's a little different because you want a higher quality recording than...
Yep.
Yeah, okay. So...
Compression.
Sometimes you'll see reporters will actually put those Olympuses on the podium and they're covering speeches, but there are better choices. I would probably pick a Zoom device. They make a number of great recorders, and they're famous for their microphones, really great microphones. I take a look at the Zoom H1 Handy Recorder. It's about $100. It records onto an SD card, so it's made... Look, here's one. We have a podcaster visiting us from Australia. He uses a Zoom. I take it you use this, Steve, for your own podcasts. So this is a little bit of an older Zoom, but this is the H2. But what's great is it records onto SD card, flash memory, so you just pop that into your computer. You can read them. They're standard WAV or MP3 files. But what Zoom's famous for is good microphones. And if you're recording lectures, Mike, I think the Zoom is a really good choice for you. The newest, the one that recently came out that's very small and very affordable is the Zoom H1. Podcasters are less likely to use this because you're doing interviews, you want really high quality. But for something like recording lectures, recording notes, dictation even, this is a really great choice. And it is only $100. The Zoom H1 Handy Recorder records high quality, CD quality, WAV files, if you have enough storage. Or if you want to make it something smaller but and easier to manage, MP3s, up to 320 kilobits, so very high quality. And you can copy it over via the USB port or just take the SD card out and copy it onto your computer. So that's a really good choice. Really like that one. Yeah, and you know, I understand people's frustration sometimes with their iPods and iPads because they can't get that stuff off of there. But really, that's by design. Stephen from Annandale, Virginia. Hi, Stephen. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi. I like your new show. I mean, your new studio a lot.
Everybody likes a new place, huh? You got to come visit us sometime, Stephen. Are you a podcaster?
No. I want to create like a new show with my friends.
Oh, that's great! I remember when I was in sixth grade. That's about where you are, right?
I'm going into seventh.
That was one of the things. It probably got me into the business that I'm in. It was the most fun thing we ever did. Was we had a fake news show that we would do in front of the class, pretend to have cameras.
That's exactly what I like.
It's so much fun.
Yeah.
And now you're lucky, Stephen, because I was doing it. You know, I mean, in front of the class. Maybe if you were really lucky in those days, the principal would let you use the PA system to talk to the whole school. I have some announcements to make. But now, thanks to the internet, you could have an internet news show. So you're looking for, you know, you said, I'm looking at the what you told our call screener, Gina. You want a mixer.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good, so you're going to have more than one person on the microphone?
Yeah, two more people.
Yeah, so you do need a mixer because you can only put one person at a time into the computer via USB. So what a mixer does is takes several microphones and then puts it into a USB connector that you can then record on your computer. I recommend there's a company called Behringer, Behringer, and they make a podcast studio product that has everything you need. It has a little mixer. Little microphone. You can get extra microphones to go with it. The mixer supports two microphones. They have one that supports more microphones. Sounds like you need the bigger one. But Behringer has a whole set of these that basically are designed. There's a FireWire one and a USB one. The FireWire one has four microphones on it. Designed for exactly what you want to do, Stephen. And I'm so jealous. Because if I were your age, with all the things available today, man, just think. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. So you remember Rebecca Black, she was the one who did Friday, comes after Thursday, right before Saturday. Well, that's her follow-up. You know, I first felt bad for her because, you know, she's a 13-year-old girl. Her parents paid a couple of $1,000 to this company that does, you know, music videos of 13-year-olds. I think usually for bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs. And then, you know, they make the cute video and they show it at the bat mitzvah. And I guess they didn't know that this company also puts it on the internet. And Rebecca Black was widely mocked for Friday. Everybody mocked her. Even, what was it? Was it Jimmy Fallon? Conan O'Brien? Somebody. Some late night show. They did a whole version of it. I mean, and I thought, oh, poor Rebecca Black. Until I realized she's loving it because she's made money on it and thinks she's a pop star. So this is her follow-up. Big rollout. Rebecca Black, her new single, This Is My Moment. You've never heard auto-tune sound so good. Anyway, a star is born. That lovely laugh, you know who that is, Scott Wilkinson, the Santa Claus of home theater. Hi, Scott.
Oh, hey, Leo.
It's good to see you once again. He is now the online editor of home, is that right?
That's right.
Of Home Theater Magazine at hometheater.com.
That's right.
And joins us every week to talk about home theater. How
of which
you?
There's always plenty to talk
there's
about.
There's no lack.
There's no lack of things to talk about. A couple of quick announcements, first of all. One is on the website, hometheater.com, we are now running our latest sweepstakes, the prize for which is an Oppo BDP-93 Universal Blu-ray player.
That's the one I have.
Very cool. Yeah, you probably actually have the 83.
I
did
have
you
the
get it a while ago?
Yeah.
This one you wouldn't care about because it is 3D capable.
Yeah. So I don't care about that. But I did buy it on your recommendation and Darth Emma's recommendation in our chat room because it's such a high-quality Blu-ray player but also plays back SACD and DVD audio, which I still have not used, but I...
But it can.
You can.
Yeah. And it's a great company. If they find a Blu-ray disc that's incompatible with their current version of the firmware, boom, they got a new firmware update out in like a week.
That's interesting. So that happens?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, really? Absolutely. Firmware updates are a fact of life with Blu-ray players. And most of them these days, you can just connect them to the internet and they'll automatically go get the latest firmware update. Or at worst, you know, you'll have to go in and say, check for updates. Oppo is the best company in the world at doing this, at keeping their player up to date.
I mean, they're more expensive. You can buy now, a $100 Blu-ray player.
And, absolutely so.
And the truth is, Blu-ray looks great even on a cheap player.
Correct. That's
it's
exactly
It's not that you're going to get a better picture out of a more expensive Blu-ray player. It's just got, more features, more compatibility.
Yeah, exactly right. This one has, you know, all the features. It's got 3D. It's got streaming. It can play all the disc formats, which not all Blu-ray players can. Most of them can't, in fact. So the Oppo is unusual in that regard. And if you want a player that does all those different disc formats you were mentioning, like SACD and DVD audio and so on, if you don't get the Oppo, you're going to spend a lot more. I mean, Denon, I think, just came out with one for $2,500.
But that would only be of interest to audiophiles, somebody with a
exactly,
nice stereo.
Exactly. But even Oppo has a BDP95, which has an upgraded analog audio output section. So if you are an audiophile, you can spend $1,000 instead of $2,500 and get exceptionally good audio quality. And even the BDP93 at $500, $499 actually, is no slouch when it comes to audio. You know, you how much better you get for the extra, for the double the money, is debatable. And whether or not you can hear it or not, if you're an audiophile, you probably can because you've got golden ears, right? But for most people, I think the 93 is perfectly fine. And all you have to do is go to hometheater.com. There's a banner at the top of the page, the home page. Just click on that. Post a comment. And by posting a comment on that story, you are entered in the sweepstakes. And at the end, beginning of September, we'll randomly pick one lucky person, and they will receive that player.
Well, that's a nice prize.
Yeah, it is a very nice prize. I'm very grateful to Oppo for their generosity on that, and it's a really great thing, so I encourage everybody to go check it out. The other quick announcement that I want to make is that I have finally played Angry Birds.
Well, the world is so relieved that you're no longer an Angry Birds virgin.
It's true. My niece was visiting before she goes off to graduate school. Hi, Maya, if you're listening. And she
this
has
something akin to saying, you know, that Doom game is pretty darn good.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, I played Angry Birds a little bit. All it is ballistic trajectories.
Yeah. Well, yes. Now, let me ask you, did you get the new Roku 2, which has Angry Birds built in?
No, I haven't seen that yet.
Yeah, and they have a special kind of controller. It's kind of like the Nintendo Wii controller.
Yes, so I understand. Yeah. I can't wait to get one, actually. I want to try it.
Yeah.
Although, I have to say, Angry Birds just looked like a terrible waste of time to me, and I don't have any time
to waste. Nobody contests that it is, in fact, a terrible waste of time, but it's a very addictive and fun game. And actually, I guess I'm kind of over it.
You know, I could sort of see the appeal, and I managed a couple of shots that Maya said, wow, that was pretty good.
It didn't appeal to me at first, Scott, so... If you don't want to get involved, don't play any more games because it takes about 10, 15 games and then you start saying, I'm hooked.
No, that's never going to happen because video games affect me much the same way as caffeine. And caffeine, I really don't like what it does to me. So I don't drink coffee. I'm very unusual in that way. Everybody needs their cup of coffee in the morning, but it makes me just feel lousy. And video games do the same thing. To me, personally. So
I find it interesting that we're starting to see, thanks to this Roku, and I imagine others will do this, Google TV, Apple TV probably, and others, that people are starting to put games on these internet-connected boxes that you can play on your big-screen TV. And they're not, you know, hardcore gamers have for years hooked up their PCs to big-screen TVs, have hooked up, you know, their PlayStation 3 to their Xbox 360. That's a great experience. But now I think what they're doing is they're getting the casual gamer involved, and that's interesting to see casual gamers. I mean, how long before people are playing solitaire on their Pioneer VT5?
Their... Well, some of them probably are, but Yeah, having them built in, sort of into the firmware of the game console or the streaming box in the case of Roku.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah.
Very interesting, yeah. It'll be an interesting thing to see develop.
So we have about three more minutes. You have a question from a listener?
I do, in fact. A question about the Oppo BDP-93, as it happens.
Uh-huh.
Peter Kukiel has a bunch of questions. We won't get to all of them today, of course, but he wants to sort of know the best way to hook up a Blu-ray player to an audio-video receiver and which one should do the video processing, the upscaling, the deinterlacing, that sort of thing. Because you can do that in the player if you have an interlaced disc. In the case of a DVD, you certainly do. Most Blu-rays are progressive. They don't send stuff out interlaced. So should the player do it or should the receiver do it? And I would add a third one. Should the display do it? Should the TV do it? There are three different places where you could do these sorts of basic video processing tasks. And the answer is, it depends. Huh.
The answer is, we'll find out after this break. That's what the answer is. Stand by. Scott Wilkinson's here, the online editor of HomeTheater.com, and more to come with him and you in just a bit. Scott, does that in any way give you any tingling feeling, any itch, any desire to run to the TV set and play Angry Birds?
No.
No. Then you're all right. Then you're safe. For those of you at home who are now starting to shake uncontrollably, I'm sorry. The Angry Birds theme. See, Scott didn't even recognize it.
I didn't.
So now let's get back to our question because we ran out of time. You had you had an email from to HomeTheater.com from a listener or viewer or reader.
Right. By the way, my email address is scott@techguylabs.com.
Good. Yes.
So please send me your questions, and I answer them on the site and here on the show.
And he asked about this Oppo Blu-ray player we've been talking about.
Right, exactly. And the more general question is, you got a Blu-ray player connected to an AV receiver, connected to a TV, and there's going to be some video processing going on at one of those stages along the way. Which stage is the best? Or all of them. You don't want it to happen in all of them. That would not be a good thing.
I've always wondered this, too, with an upscaling DVD player. Who should do the upscaling? The DVD player? The TV?
It's a very good question. And the answer is best to find out by doing a little experiment. And the little experiment is, first of all, set your DVD player to do the upconverting. It'll only do that via the HDMI output, so you need a receiver with an HDMI input and a TV with an HDMI connection to the receiver. So you set the player to do it, and it will send 1080p to the receiver. The receiver will say, oh, I've got 1080p, I don't have to do anything to that, and send it onto the TV, and the TV will say the same thing. Next, you take a look at a clip, something that you know pretty well. You play a disc that you know pretty well. Then you go back and you play that same disc, but you disable the upconversion in the DVD player, and you enable it in the receiver. You go into the receiver's menu, and it'll say video processing, and you'll say enable the video processing. So then the receiver does it. Then, and watch the same clip. Then turn off the video processing in the receiver and in the DVD player. It'll just send 480 throughout the chain all the way to the TV, and the TV will do the upscaling, do the upconversion. Watch the same clip again for three times. You're going to do this. And which one looks better? Whichever one looks the best is the one you should use, and it's pretty easy. One of the great clips I use for this is Chapter 8 of Mission Impossible 3 on DVD, and it works really well because there's a slow pan across a very finely detailed staircase, supposedly in the Vatican. And that slow pan is murder on deinterlacers.
So you'll see, what will you see if it's not?
You will see a type of distortion called moiré, which looks kind of wavy and kind of psychedelic a little bit. And you'll see all kinds of jitteriness and stuff in that staircase. And whichever processor you use and you see the least amount of that jitteriness in the staircase is the processor you should use to upconvert DVDs. and probably everything else. So it's really pretty simple. You just have to do a little experiment to find out which of your devices has the better video processor. Now, the Oppo's got a great one. A lot of receivers now have great ones. This guy has, can't see exactly which one it is, but it's a pretty good pretty good receiver. Oh, no, he wants to buy a receiver. So Pioneer, Marantz, Onkyo, they all use good video processors. So that should work pretty well. And depending on the TV you've got, that might work really well, too.
So there's no rule of thumb that the TV is going to be better or the receiver is going to be better. It's just you have to look.
You just have to look.
And do you have to turn it off on one of them, or will it already sense that its processing has been done? You don't want to double process, I understand.
No, that's true. But you're not going to run into many problems in that regard because whatever's doing the processing, the device downstream from that is going to get a 1080p signal and going to go, oh, I don't need to process this. It's already at 1080p.
Got it. So they won't conflict.
They really won't conflict. No, that's correct.
Scott is the online editor, hometheater.com. He also does a great podcast, The Home Theater Geeks, tomorrow, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern at live.twit.tv. Who's going to be on the show tomorrow?
Michael Fremmer, audiophile extraordinaire.
How fun.
This guy is very seriously opinionated about all things audiophile, so it's going to be a very lively discussion.
I look forward to that. Thank you, Scott.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Good to talk to you. We're going to get back to the phones in just a second. In fact, our next caller, Lewis in Reading, Pennsylvania, wants to know about bandwidth use and bandwidth caps. Yep. Lewis in Reading, PA. Hey, Lewis, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo.
Welcome to the show. What can I do for you?
My mom is having a problem. We have Comcast, and they have that 250 gig cap. And we've been noticing the last couple months, we're getting kind of close to that. We don't understand why. Initially, we did eventually find out what it was.
You know, Comcast says, oh, nobody will ever hit 250 gigs. That's less than 1% of all of our users. But I got to tell you, they did that a year or two ago when it was true, but as people use their internet more and more, it's not going to be true. And people like you and your mom, Lewis, are kind of on the leading edge of what's going to happen. Comcast doesn't want you watching movies on the internet because then you're not buying their expensive video on demand products.
Yep.
They don't.
And that's what's happening.
Yeah.
I mean, what we have going on, and that's what I'm trying to figure out, is how we can curtail it a little so we don't hit that cap. So I'm trying to figure out what stuff that we're doing here is contributing to that cap. I mean, my sister likes to watch Netflix, and she streams all her music, or all her movies. And my brothers play video games, one on Xbox.
The video games aren't too bad in all likelihood. The movies, Comcast, or Netflix, will go as high as 1 to 2 gigabytes an hour. So if it's going at the highest quality, if you're getting HD and really good looking movies on Netflix, and you may be, because Comcast does have good bandwidth, don't they? I mean, they give you a lot of bits per second.
I'm not complaining about the internet.
But it would. So if your sister watched a 2-hour movie every night, that's 4 gigabytes a night. Right there, that's 120 gigabytes if she does it every night. That's not all of it, but it's a good amount of it.
Oh, very true. And my mom said to me today that she just looked at her her bandwidth usage meter on their website, and it says that we're at like 230 gig.
Are you using – now, the guy who got dinged in Seattle, Comcast, by the way, canceled his account for 2 years, was using Carbonite to do backup. Remember, it's uploads as well as downloads.
Exactly.
If you're using Carbonite and backing up – many, many gigabytes, that could also do it.
We don't have any backup service,
okay.
And we're not really using like any cloud-based services either.
That's interesting.
Standard usage that a normal family would be using.
Lewis, you're not downloading movies from other sources?
Me personally, no. I'm not really sure if anyone in the house is like doing any kind of heavy downloading.
Another thing to watch out for, if you've got Wi-Fi, you are using WPA password protection on it, right?
That was our initial problem 2 months ago when we first saw the problem and we fixed it.
The neighbor was using it.
that's what we figured out. Yeah, we figured like somebody was piggybacking on us, and you know Comcast, they don't care about that.
No, they shouldn't care. It's you're responsible. Yeah.
Exactly. So we password protected it, and then last month it seemed to be okay. But now we're spiking up again, and we're not figuring out how that.
Change your password. I think you got a naughty neighbor.
Well, that they cracked our
WPA can't be, if it's WEP, that could be easily cracked.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to figure. I'll have to look and see if it's WP or
make sure it's WPA, and then use a password that can't be easily guessed. You have to use a strong password.
Okay, and my brother just came in and said that the password isn't under WEP, it's WPA.
Good.
So.
Well, that's one thing I'd look at. And, you know, I wish that Comcast gave you more granular information. That's the best you could do. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. And it's time to talk computers. Home theater, as we just did. Cell phones. Digital doodads and doohickeys. No, not hickeys, doohickeys. 88 Ask Leo. Our camera guy, Chris Marquardt, will be on in just a bit to talk about digital photography and reiterate our assignment. The assignment isn't like a contest or anything. We just like to give you an excuse to go out and take pictures. But here's an assignment right now. Call me, 8888-ASK-LEO, and we could talk about tech. I can answer your questions. There are no dumb questions. There are only dumb answers. 8888-ASK-LEO. The big Black Hat conference just concluded in Las Vegas, and DEF CON is going on right now. They're back-to-back hacker conferences in Las Vegas. Black Hat is kind of more serious and official and gets members of the federal government, the FBI, the Secret Service, law enforcement, and a lot of hackers together to talk about. And by the way, most of the time these hackers that I mentioned are not criminals. They're people who hack. See, I think a lot of times people think hacker, that's a criminal. No, a hacker is somebody who takes technology of any kind, hardware or software, and gets it to do things it wasn't designed to do. They're people who hack away at systems and break them sometimes, sometimes find security flaws. And sometimes there are hackers, people prefer maybe that we call them crackers, who use this knowledge to, you know, ill ends, to break into systems, to spread malware, to spam, that kind of thing. Black Hat tends to be more corporate, more official. DEF CON, which follows it, is a little bit more of a free-for-all. Not that the government guys don't go there. They do. They just they can keep a low profile because that's where they're looking around for the bad guys. And there are some people at DEF CON who are a little sketch. I've never been to DEF CON. I have a good friend, Patrick Norton, who's been many times. He said, don't bring a laptop. Because one of the fun things they like to do is hack people's laptops, hack into their laptops, and then put them on the wall of shame of people whose systems were hacked at DEF CON. So he says, you don't want to bring a laptop. You don't want to bring an iPad. You're just asking for trouble. So one of the demos this week at the Black Hat Technical Security Conference came from a couple of professionals from ISEC Partners. That's a security firm. And get this. This is one of the things that's interesting. We always get great in news out of Black Hat and DEF CON because this is where hackers like to hold on every year to their best exploits and show them off to their peers. And get this one. This one is scary. These two guys from ISEC Partners showed how they can use an Android phone and a text message to send a message to a Subaru Outback, unlocking the car and starting the engine. By setting up their own telephone network, their own GSM network, they were able to snatch up password authentication messages being sent from server to car. They hacked in using that password, and they were able to start the car up and basically drive off. They call this war texting. What happens is more and more devices in our cars and other things are online. They're online. And they have tracking devices, GPS. They have OnStar and other emergency calling services. They have security cameras. They have all sorts of sensors. And it's not just cars. It's their power grid. It's home automation. It's water supply. It's all over. And unfortunately, these systems aren't really being designed with security in mind. But that one blew me away. Hackers were able to break into a Subaru Outback, sending a text message, and get not only the car to open up, say, come on, guys, let's go for a ride. They started the engine and all that. Wow. Wow. This is why I actually enjoy this time of year, because you get all these hacker stories from DEF CON. Of course, this is Shark Week. The Discovery Channel really has done a great job. I don't know how many decades have they been doing Shark Week. But it really has become a thing now. I liked this post on darncoolpictures.com. Things that kill more people than sharks. See, sharks, despite everybody's fear of them, aren't really that deadly. There's maybe one or two shark attacks, maybe three a year. Obesity kills 30,000 people a year. Lightning kills 10,000 people a year. Texting while driving kills 6,000 people. Hippos are more dangerous than sharks. Hippos kill worldwide almost 3,000 people every year. Airplanes, 1,200 people. Volcanoes, 845 people. Shopping on Black Friday kills 550 people a year. Falling out of bed, 400 people die every year. Bathtubs, 340 people. Deer are more deadly than sharks. Deer kill 130 people every year. In Russia, 100 people a year alone in Russia die of icicles. Tornadoes, jellyfish are more deadly than sharks. So you can watch Shark Week, but don't forget, sharks don't kill. There may be about 5 people a year. We're doing a lot more damage to sharks these days than sharks are doing to us. And stay away from the jellyfish. Those things are scary. John in Burlington, Ontario. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, John.
Hi, Leo. Good afternoon. How are you today?
I'm very well. Stay away from the deer. They're deadly.
Well, funny story, you should mention the cars automatically starting. I was at a party yesterday.
Yeah.
And I parked across the road, and I had these people coming over saying, who owns the blue vehicle across the road? It's running. I must have hit the button in my Ford.
Say, yeah, you have one of those things that starts up the car remotely?
Yep.
You got to be careful.
Yeah, I know. And so I went over, shut it off. It only goes for 15 minutes, which is a good thing.
Yeah, that's for people who live in freezing cold weather, as you do.
Yeah.
And you want to start the car up before you go out to drive it off. You need to warm it up. So basically what you're saying is you butt dialed your car.
Yeah, basically.
Can I help you with I love that.
It has nothing to do with the car.
Yeah.
Something to do with the party, though.
Okay.
I was at this family party yesterday, and a lot of people took pictures. I want to be able to put the pictures together in a video. From everybody else, but I don't know how the best way to get them to me is
right. Without
them emailing, which makes it very difficult.
There are a number of ways to do this. This is a very popular thing to do right now. In fact, lately there have been a slew of smartphone apps designed for this kind of party photo sharing. But I think the easiest way is still Flickr. But what you have to do is at the party, you have to say to everybody, I do this when we go on the geek cruises, we'll make several announcements saying we're creating a Flickr group. And if you have some pictures from this cruise that you like, please post them on the Flickr group for everyone to share. And you can do the same thing at a party. Maybe you print up a little flyer or something, because sometimes people don't know about Flickr or know how to use Flickr. But the key on this has got to be something that everybody at the party can figure out how to use. And I'll be honest, what I found is that people have digital cameras, but doesn't mean that they're technically sophisticated enough to figure out how to share online.
No, because most of them are point and shoot, so they just point
exactly.
And shoot.
And many of them never even take it off the. This is one that gets me. They never take it off the memory card.
Yeah,
that's how they look. I know you know somebody like this, folks. They take pictures with a digital camera. They don't know that they could take the pictures off onto their computer, or don't care, or just don't bother. They have, because the cards now hold hundreds of pictures, they may have 500 pictures. The way they look at their pictures, they look at them in the camera. And I don't know what they do when it comes time to, when the memory gets filled up. Maybe they just buy another card. John, I'll give you some more suggestions, and I'll mention some of these great photo apps, too, in just a bit. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We'll be right back. bigger boat. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We've been talking with John in Burlington, Ontario. And he's looking for a way to share pictures that were taken at a party so he can make a video. And I was during the break, I was showing the chat room something called Animoto, A-N-I-M-O-T-O.com, that takes pictures and automatically generates kind of a fancy video out of it. The problem is, how sophisticated are these people at the party? If they were kind of sophisticated, then you could get them to upload these images to Animoto, and you could press a button, and it would automatically generate the video. I mean, I think Flickr's though the easiest thing to do. There are other photo sharing sites. We were talking also about off the air about so many people know people who just never pull the pictures off the camera. One fella in the chat room was telling me about a friend of his who just would buy a new camera every time the memory card got full. other people who, and this is what my wife does, they wait till the card gets full and they bring the camera, the whole thing, to the drugstore and get prints made. Because nowadays they'll do that. And then you have to say to them, please erase the card now that I have my 500 prints. So, unfortunately, you can't assume technical ability on the part of the people who are at the party, John. But okay. I think Flickr would be the best bet. Send them an email saying, you might even have to say step by step, you know, join Flickr, it's free, upload your photos, you know, find the group, join the group, upload your photos to the group, that kind of thing.
Okay.
Hey, yep, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. And Animoto does do fun stuff. It's not. It's free if you don't mind to make a video longer than 30 seconds. But then it gets kind of expensive pretty quickly. But if you want to do high-def videos, downloadable videos, that kind of thing. They've been around for a while, and it's the service has gotten more and more expensive, and I suspect that's because it's pretty darn hard to make money doing this kind of thing. Animoto.com. But if you're not a video editor, or you don't want to take the time to make videos, which it's a very time-consuming process. This does a pretty good job automatically. You just upload the pictures, tell it what song to use, and it makes a video for you. Andy's in Beaver, Utah. Andy, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Well, hello there, Leo.
Hello there, Andy.
I drive truck for a living. I'm usually out 5-6 weeks at a time. And up till now, the wife has been recording stuff off the satellite at home onto VHS tape, which is a VCR. And then, of course, I give her the tapes I've watched while I'm out here, and she hands me a whole stack of new ones.
You actually have a VCR and a TV in your truck?
Yes, I do.
Wow. That's a big truck.
It's a combination TV-VCR, so you know it's been around for a while, because how long have you been since you've seen a VCR?
I know, no kidding. Well, and nowadays, the good news is more and more companies are expecting you to do digital versions, which means you could probably duplicate this capability with a laptop.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about. We now have an HD DVR that feeds two different TVs at the house, and the wife can DVR stuff in standard format, so I can watch it on this old ancient television of mine. But I suppose I could do the same thing with the laptop. What I would like to do is somehow use an external hard drive on the DVR and have two of them. And when I watch the stuff on out here on the road, I can hand her the hard drive I've already watched, and she can give me a fresh one. Question is, how do I watch off of an external hard drive that was attached to the DVR on my laptop?
Yeah, unfortunately... the movie industry does not want you to do this, of course, because this would be a vehicle for piracy. And so most DVRs...
Peg leg, yeah.
Yeah, most DVRs... Yeah. Arr! Andy, I can tell you're a pirate. Well, basically, the movie industry thinks we're all pirates, you know. And so they treat us all like, well, you're going to steal it. You're going to rob us blind, so we better... make sure that you can't do that. And so what they do is they make it hard for you to play those DVR recordings anywhere but on the DVR. You can actually buy external hard drives for DVRs. Many DVRs allow you to do that. but you'll have to have a duplicate DVR in the truck to play it back.
Okay.
There are, you know, TiVo has a TiVo to go feature that's designed to do this. It is not as easy as it ought to be. I mean, you've got on the hard drive all these already digitized movies. It'd be great if you could just put those files on a disc and just take them with you, but they don't let.
I only plan on basically watching them once, and then, you know, it's just like the VCR. I'd give her the tape, and she'd just record over the top of it with something else.
Can you get online everywhere you go in your truck?
Well, I can, and I do use Hulu and a couple of other places that I go to watch television, but I'm running into the same problem everybody else does. I use a Verizon modem with a 5-gigabyte cap. And
yeah, I was going to suggest Slingbox, which would let you actually watch the stuff on the DVR at home over the Internet. But
okay.
you have to have a decent Internet connection. That's the only negative.
Yeah, and, you know, sometimes I do, sometimes I don't, because, of course, I don't know where I'm going to be sleeping from one night to the next.
Of course. And some truck stops have great Internet access, and sometimes they don't.
Oh, most of them don't.
Most of them nowadays, yeah. Well, you know why? It used to be fine until all the truckers got computers.
Oh, yeah. We all sophisticated out here.
Yeah.
We're all...
So it was fine when there was a few guys using the Internet, but now they've got 100 trucks using the Internet, and nobody can get anything.
Well, if you can shut down around 1, 2 o'clock in the afternoon,
exactly.
You've got Internet until about 5 when the truck stops.
They all show up, exactly. I would say, now the problem is you'd have to get a TiVo for this. What is I presume your DVR is not a TiVo box, but probably something that came from the cable company.
Yes, we have Dish Network, and it came from them. It's the receiver for, you know, DVR is built into the receiver, and, you know, they want to make it as convenient as possible to the point where it's not convenient anymore.
Right. Well, it's convenient as long as you want to watch it on the DVR.
Yep.
And that's the trick. Now, if you Google, you know, saving Dish DVR videos, there are a lot of entries of people who are trying to figure out how to do this. I wrote a whole book on how to do this for the TiVo, but that was way back in the days of the TiVo 1, and TiVo wised up, and they started encrypting those files, so you couldn't get that stuff off. I'm just looking and seeing if I can. Yeah, it looks like there are quite a few articles about this.
Okay.
Turn on your Dish DVR, press the play button. Yeah, a lot of them involve something called the analog hole. If you can play back a video from the DVR onto a TV, you can capture it. Instead of playing it to the TV, you play it to a recorder of some kind. Again,
okay.
Lots of trouble, but you can do that. If you want to use the Dish DVR, it's just not going to be that easy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Right, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. And look who's here, my good friend, Mr. Chris Marquardt.
Hello, how's it going?
Our photo guy. It's great, Chris. How are you?
I'm doing really good. I'm packing. I'm flying out to the United States tomorrow.
Oh, you got your workshops coming up.
Yep, going to spend a few days in Washington before I then hold a workshop on the weekend. And then I'll come to San Francisco. And then I'll come up to Petaluma.
Yes, you're going to come visit, and we're going to do a show with Chris. Chris
on the 17th
is from Germany, Tübingen, Germany, and he does his own video and audio podcast called Tips from the Top Floor, all about photography.
And, that's right.
We're glad to have you join us every week to talk about photography.
Yes, and today I want to talk about flash photography. How do you like
not photography while you're flashing?
No. Using the flash on your camera. You know how sometimes those pictures come out like really, really not that nice?
Horrible. Let's be honest. Horrible.
There are several ways how flash can light a scene. The worst case is if the flash says, I'm the boss. I take over. I make all the light for that photo. And it basically kills all the other light. It flattens out your subject. And as a result, you end up with a very brightly lit person with no depth because of the frontal light and with the With a small in-camera flash, you know how the light falls off very fast?
Yes.
So the background goes pretty much black. Now, today's DSLRs are a little bit better because when they take a picture by default, they basically take two pictures, actually. Now, imagine a scene in a dark room. Let's say at night at a party or something. Now, the light meter in your camera, there's this little thing that measures how bright it is and sets the exposure accordingly. Mm-hmm. That does two light measurements, one for the entire scene that includes the background and one for the subject.
Right.
And now when you press the button on your camera, the camera will open its shutter and it'll open it long enough, actually very long, to allow for a well-exposed background. And then it fires its flash while that exposure takes place and that lights your subject. So you get two different parts of the scene, the foreground lit by the flash and the background lit by, well, the long exposure. Now, remember, the flash is not strong enough to light the background, so it'll only reach the subject. It won't light the background. And that makes for really interesting effects because then all of a sudden you'll end up with camera shake. For example, in the background, you'll have the blurry background because you held the camera, let's say, for half a second. Sometimes those exposures can get really long, so you expose for the background, and then the flash freezes your subject, freezes the motion of your subject. So you will end up with this sort of blurry, dreamy background and a frozen in motion subject. And that's, by the way, what experts call dragging the shutter.
And that's what we want. That's a good look.
And that's what you want.
Yeah.
Now, here's an advanced trick, because by default, that flash will go off at the beginning of that long exposure.
Right.
But it looks much more natural if that flash fires at the end of that exposure.
So dragging the so tell me again how to do this, because I want to try this.
Well, by default, you set your camera to one of the modes, such as aperture priority,
right?
For example,
right.
And then the camera will make an exposure that will light the background.
Okay.
And then in addition to that,
go ahead.
In addition to that, it'll fire the flash to light your subject. So you will not end up with this black hole kind of picture where the background is totally black, but the background will be well exposed.
Okay, I'm going to do this one more time because I still don't get it. So I have my camera, and I have on the dial have A for aperture priority.
Exactly.
That means I'm going to still use automatic exposure controls, but I will get to pick how wide open the aperture is, how wide open the lens is.
Yep.
Does it matter what I pick?
Well, at night you want to pick something with a very small number, which will give you a wide opening, so a lot of light can come in.
Okay, so I'm gonna pick a low number aperture, as low as I can, and still get a proper exposure. Actually, since I'm doing a flash, I could probably set it to the minimum, can't I?
Yeah, but then don't get scared, because then your camera will choose a long exposure.
Right.
Sometimes a very long exposure. It'll probably even warn you that, wait a minute, this is probably too long. You won't be able to handle
it. It might blink red at me in the viewfinder saying, I can't do this. What are you, nuts? But because we have the flash,
the flash will freeze the subject and the background kind of getting shaky and the lights in the background.
That's okay.
Giving you some shades. It's totally okay. Actually, that's a very wanted effect. Photographers actually want that effect sometimes with these kind of shots.
So you may have a 3-second exposure or something.
Yes.
But do continue to hold the camera for the entire exposure at relatively still. But the flash, because it's only a thousandth of a second or whatever, is going to get that main image that you want. And then a little shaky in the background is okay.
And the pro tip is, check the manual of your camera for something that's called second curtain sync, because that's what you want. You want to set your flash to shoot at the end of that long exposure, not at the beginning of that long exposure.
So some cameras will have this capability, some won't. Second curtain sync.
DSLRs usually have that.
All right. See, I've heard you describe this before, and to be honest, I just let it wash over me like a...
try it out when I'm in
Petaluma. One day I'll do this. So now I'm interested. Okay. So two things to do. Use aperture priority, set the exposure, which may be a long exposure. In fact, it's good if it's a half a second or a second. It's good if it's a long exposure.
Yes.
Then set the camera to second curtain sync if you have that availability. And, of course, turn on the flash. Now, what if people are moving around? I guess it doesn't matter, right?
Well, the flash will still freeze them because it's so short, so it'll freeze the motion. You might have a bit of an artifact of their motion during the long exposure, but that will add to the atmosphere.
Okay. And remember that if you do have second curtain sink, as Web8209 is pointing out in the chat room, that the flash is going to go off at the end of the exposure, not the beginning of the exposure. So if people are moving around, you're not going to get what they're doing at the beginning. You're going to get what they're doing half a second or a second later.
Yeah, you have to practice a bit, but the results are really, really fun. They look really good.
I'm very intrigued by this. This is called dragging the shutter.
The shutter.
Dragging the shutter, which makes no sense. It has nothing to do with the shutter or dragging it. But anyway,
yeah,
that's what they call
it. It's an old term. It's been used for ages.
I love this. The great thing about Chris is because he was a computer guy and a programmer for many years, he's very technical, and yet he's a great artist. If you've ever seen his pictures, go to chrismarquardt.com and you can see his pictures. He's got great pictures from all over the world, the Himalayas and everything. He's coming to the States. You could take his photo workshops if you go to discoverthetopfloor.com. And let's not forget, I think we have another week on our assignment. Is that right?
We have another week on the assignment. The topic is busy. And all you do is you go to flickr.com/groups/techguy, and you submit your picture, you add it to the group, and it's got to do something with the word busy.
I got a new camera. I treated myself to a new camera.
Oh, what is it?
Let me explain. I want to do, you've inspired me because you do a great workshop on street photography. And I've seen some great photographers doing street photography. We interviewed a guy named Zach Arias, who's just a wonderful photographer. I'm sure you know who he is. He's
yes.
Just great. Does some great street photography. And it inspired me. I want to do street photography means going out and taking pictures of people on the street. And the problem I have, and we've talked about this before, is as soon as I lift the camera, my big, heavy Canon 5D Mark II to my eyes, everybody goes, freezes, and they do one of two things. They either smile, they pose, or they put their hands in front of their face and say, no pictures, no pictures.
No pictures.
So I got a little tiny, silent, but good quality camera, the Fujifilm X100. And I'm going to go out and take some street pictures. Maybe some of them will be busy. ChrisMarquardt.com. Thank you, Chris.
Sure.
So, Kyle, you picked up on the one word, diva. And now you're playing a song about divas.
It's Beyonce.
It's Beyonce. What could be wrong with that? Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888. Ask Leo. It's always a pleasure to work with Kyle Benham. We missed you last weekend. Kyle had the weekend off because he does such a great job with these crazy music tracks that he plays for us. Always trying to tie it in somehow to the conversation at hand. I was talking about this X100, which is a crazy expensive camera. It's $1,200. It's ridiculous considering it's basically a point and shoot. Chris called it the diva camera. It's the diva of cameras. It's brilliant, talented, wonderful, but very quirky. And I knew this because I followed my own advice and I read all the reviews online. There's two places I go for reviews. DPReview.com, which is great. Hello. And I guess I'm getting a little Skype sound still from Chris. I'll turn that down. DPReview.com, which is great, and then DigitalCameraInfo.com. Great. So before you buy a digital camera, these are two sites. Write these down that you'll want. Well, we'll put in the show notes at TechGuyLabs.com. James DeRuvo put it in there. But DPReview.com, as in DigitalPhotographyReview.com, and DigitalCameraInfo.com. Both these companies really work hard to do a lot of image quality testing, color accuracy testing, but they also test the ergonomics, the controls, and both raved about the image quality of this Fujifilm camera. They said this is an amazing camera and just panned it for the ergonomics, the usability. They said, oh, terrible usability. So try it before you buy it, they said. Did I? No. That's the advice I didn't follow. 8888, ask Leo, I should learn. Robert's on the line from the East Bay, California, listening on the great KGO in San Francisco. Hey, Robert.
How's it going, Leo?
It's great. How are you?
Doing good, man. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Well, welcome. It's about time.
Yeah, I know. So I basically cut all the cords for the cable.
Wow, you're a cord cutter. This is a new term for this, the cord cutter you are.
Yeah, I'm following along with the trends of trying to save money.
I sound a little like Yoda there. Ah, cord cutter you are. So yeah, that means you're not paying for cable television. You're not, or a satellite dish, but you're getting all of your, it doesn't mean you've given up TV entertainment, but you're just getting all your stuff from the internet.
Yeah, and I even have a coat hanger antenna.
So you, oh, that's interesting. So you cut the cable, but you still have an antenna.
Yeah, I mean, I pick up the HD channels over the air on my plasma so I can get the news still.
That's awesome.
Looks really good.
I mean, there's a few things you miss, and I think you've handled it one way, but by saying with the antenna, I could get live programming, breaking news, Academy Awards, Super Bowl, things that you won't see on the internet.
Uh-huh.
So that was smart.
That's true.
Yeah.
I don't get, I mean, the East Bay, I'm not picking up with the antenna. I'm not picking up like ABC or NBC.
Ah, see, there's the problem.
Yeah,
that's how cable started. You know, cable didn't make any headway in the cities where people could have an antenna. They said, why should I pay, you know, $10 a month for a cable when I could just put up an antenna and get it for free? Cable made its headway in areas where antenna reception was inadequate. So they'd put up a big antenna and then pipe that up here in Petaluma in the North Bay. Same thing. We can't get the San Francisco stations. So cable did very well here because it gave you access to the San Francisco network stations that you couldn't get otherwise. Same thing, I'm sure, in the East Bay.
Yeah. And then another thing, so I have Comcast. I have the Blast package where, you know, you get up to 20 megabits per
second.
Yeah,
that's misleading.
Yes, definitely.
Because what happens is it's 20 megabits per second, yes, for the first few seconds. And
exactly.
Then it goes way. But that's fine if it's websites, pages pop in. But it's just not so good for downloading video, anything that's continuous. That was their thinking.
I'm streaming through the Xbox, through my Roku. I got my XBMC home theater set up, trying to watch something there while my wife's online, and I'm nonstop buffering. So I'm thinking about going to the business class just because I've had friends tell me that I'd have a higher level in like bandwidth.
The number you want is not peak bandwidth, it's sustained bandwidth. It's just like hard drives. They used to rate hard drives peak transfer speed. That's how fast it could go briefly. But you don't care about how fast it can go briefly. You care about how fast it's going to be sustained over a period of however long you're watching a TV show, for instance.
Exactly.
And now, here's the thing. You don't need all that much bandwidth to get good quality HD video. If you have 4 or 5 consistent megabits, that's plenty. So, you know, and truthfully, if your consumer-grade Comcast with 20 megabits blast probably is giving you 8 or 9 megabits sustained throughput, that should be enough.
Yeah, I don't know I didn't change the settings on my Netflix.
I think part of the problem is... And I have, by the way, I have the same Comcast with the boost and all of that, 20 megabits, and it slows down. But where I really have trouble with buffering is prime time.
It's about, right. I'm in an apartment, too.
You know why? Because everybody's watching Netflix. They're all doing it. Now, this is a drawback. By the way, I switched from my cable provider to DSL for this reason. This is a drawback with the way the internet works. The difference between cable and DSL. Cable, the choke point is nearer to you. There's always a choke point on the internet, the place where your connection gets on to the public internet. If they buy enough bandwidth at the choke point, if they provide enough bandwidth at the choke point, it doesn't matter. You know, the problem is the choke point, how many people are using it at the choke point? So in the case of a cable head end, you've got a head end in your neighborhood that is provided with bandwidth. Whatever it is. If one person's using it, he gets all of that bandwidth. Two people using it, they share half and half. Three people, a third. You could see very quickly if the head end is providing 100 customers and they're all watching Netflix at the same time, then Comcast has to pump more bandwidth into that head end. But guess what? Comcast doesn't want to because they're mad at you. Because you cut the cable. You cut the cord. You said, I don't want your expensive video on demand. I don't want your expensive HBO. I want your less expensive net or internet access. And so they have no incentive at all. Now, there's still a choke point on DSL, but it's the phone, it's at the phone central office. Each person on a DSL connection has a direct connection, unshared connection, to the central office. So now, it, of course, the DSL provider has to buy enough connectivity to the central office to satisfy all of his customers. It's absolutely possible for a DSL provider to have too many customers for the connection that they go and have in the central office. But remember, they're not in the video on demand business. So, you know, well, in most cases, if it's AT&T, they do have UVerse. If it's Verizon, they do have Fios. They do have TV signals. But in most cases, it is in their interest to provide sufficient bandwidth to the central office. So sometimes DSL, even though DSL doesn't have that 20 megabit peak speed, it has more consistent sustained speed, particularly in prime time when all of these people are watching Netflix at the same time. You, if you're on DSL, you have a direct connection to the central office. Now, if the DSL provider doesn't account for that when buying bandwidth for the central office, you'll still have a choke point. It's just farther upstream.
All right.
So I think this is, I think that you and I, Robert, have this, we're both in the San Francisco Bay Area. That's the regional Comcast provider. I think you and I have the same problem. Does it work okay in the middle of the day?
Yeah, and I've heard you talk about that a lot going to AT&T, and I've thought about it. But yeah, I'm in an apartment complex. I don't know if that matters.
It does matter because Comcast Guarantee You has one head end for the entire complex.
Yeah, and I see the Comcast van here daily.
Yeah, because you know why? Because all of your neighbors are saying the same thing. I don't know what happens, but at 7 o'clock, I can't watch TV.
Right.
Because they're all watching Netflix. And this is Netflix is now 40% of all prime time traffic on the internet. And this is exactly what I knew would happen. And Comcast, remember, has no incentive to fix it. Unless they're going to lose you as an internet customer, then they might. But really, what they want, they don't want you watching Netflix. They want you watching video on demand because it's more expensive. They make $6 on that individual movie instead of, you know, what is your internet data rate? $30 or $40 a month. So it's an interesting problem. And you're not alone, Robert. We all are suffering from this. I am suffering from this. I'll tell you what, I'm moving to DSL and I will let you know how that works out. I will let you know. Often DSL is a better choice. Oh, no, we're out of time. No. Okay. I hate it when that happens. I was going to tell you about Carbonite. I'll do that when I get back. More of your calls to come. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Here, the tech guy, talking computers, the internet, cell phones, camcorders, MP3 players, home theaters, all that jazz, and bad internet access too. You want to call in with a question, a comment, a suggestion, a complaint, a rant? My number is 8888 Ask Leo, 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. 8888 Ask Leo. We've got a visitor in studio, as we often do. We have an open studio and encourage and allow people to come by, say hi, and visit. Jay is here with his daughters, Alex and Vic. Hi, Alex. Hi, Vic. He's an online book author. In fact, he has a book that he offers for free called True Trust, about creating trusts. He's an estate planner. But it's a web page. It's a book that you can read on the web. Is that right, Jay? It's HTML.
Yes.
So he was saying, I'd like to make an ebook out of this, but how do I do it? How do I take what is essentially web pages and then turn them into a book that you could either sell on Amazon, offer for the Kindle or other ebook readers and so forth? That's really become the future, hasn't it? These electronic books. And I think there is a good way to do it. And our chat room kind of pointed me in this direction. Actually, it was a book, ebook management program that Andy Inatko suggested. He is one of our hosts of our Mac show, Mac Break Weekly. It's called Calibre, spelled the British way, C-A-L-I-B-R-E. You can Google Calibre or go to calibre-ebook.com. And it allows you, there's Windows versions, Mac versions, Linux versions. There's even a portable version you can put on a USB key. It allows you to take any ebook format and convert it into any other ebook format, which is nice. But it also, Jay, will help you take your web page, your HTML, that's how the web is formatted, and turn it into EPUB or MOBI. MOBI is Amazon's proprietary format. That's what's used on the Kindle. Although Amazon has announced, and I'm very pleased that they did, they've announced that they're going to also support the open EPUB standard. EPUB is really the format to put things in. Kindle will support it. The Barnes & Noble reader supports it, and many other third-party readers like the Kobo support it. So EPUB, if you're EPUB compatible, I think you're ready to do that. And Harlequin in our chat room says that there's another way to do it. It's called Sigil or Sigil. He says Sigil Release Candidate 2 is essentially a WYSIWYG HTML editor that will save out as EPUB. So Sigil would be another way to do it. S-I-G-I-L. I'm not sure. I guess the best place to get it is on their blog, SigilDev, S-I-G-I-L-D-E-V .blogspot.com. They have links there. So there's a couple of different ways to take what you're doing, especially if it's a web page, and convert it into something that people can read on their Kindle. And that's clearly the future, isn't it? That's clearly the future. So a couple of good ways to do that. You're not stuck once you've done that formatting. And, of course, you can use Microsoft Word or any other word processor to create these documents as well. Eddie, Priceville, Alabama. So you have a Flash-heavy site, Eddie.
Yes, I sure do.
What's the site so I can take a look at it? What's the site?
It's JanaBerryArty.com. JanaBerryArty.com.
And is she an artist?
Yes, artist and author. We visited you at the Twit Cottage last summer.
I remember that. Yeah, I love her art.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I just wonder about the Splash-based website for the future. Do I need to try to get that into a different format?
You really do. So it's very tempting. She does beautiful watercolors. She writes short stories. And it's very tempting to use Flash because you can make the site be very interactive and visual. And, when you show the paintings, they dissolve one to the other and everything. But here's the good news. All of this now can be done using modern web standards. Here's what happened with Flash. Apple, in their infinite wisdom, decided not to include Flash on the iPhone or on the iPad. And I'm sad to say, well, I'm not sad to say, but I'll be neutral on this. In some ways, I'm happy to say what happened is that because of that, because Flash sites like yours don't work on the iPhone and iPad, people started abandoning Flash. And I don't think that's a bad thing because Flash really uses up a lot of CPU cycles. It makes your page heavy, and frankly, it makes it inaccessible to people who aren't, who are blind or using screen readers or in some ways not using a traditional browser. They're not going to be able to see your lovely wife's art. So I think it would behoove you, I'm sorry to say, I know you probably put a lot of work into this.
Uh-huh.
It says it was created with Wix.com. Is that software or is that a third party?
It's a website.
Okay. So Wix is going to have problems because obviously Wix is a Flash-based service. They're going to have to deal with this. I would take a look at something like Squarespace.com. You've got all the images, right? All the stuff that went into this.
Yes.
I would say, Squarespace can support Flash, but try not to use Flash. Use what we call HTML5. You could do all the animation. Or you can hire somebody to do it, or you can, if you're interested, you can learn it, Eddie. You can do all this stuff. Everything I'm seeing on Jan's site, you can do in HTML5. None of this is Flash only. YouTube, which use Flash for all the videos on YouTube, for instance, is now converting them to a format that will work on the iPad and the iPhone. But it's not just the iPhone. It really is about making a site that's more modern. So this looks great. I mean, it's really nicely done, and I love Jan's art. But the Flash is going to, in the long run, it's going to get in the way. So bad news, Eddie. You gotta leave the Flash behind. And it's, by the way, highly insecure. Another reason not to like it. 8888 Ask Leo.
Flash dance,
I get it. Kyle Benham does it again. How could I have not gotten that, Kyle? So
I know you.
Go ahead.
You're usually great.
I missed that one. Should have known. Flash dance. So Adobe does have a Flash solution. I should have mentioned this. They see the writing on the wall. They realize that people are abandoning Flash, and they need to do something to enter this modern world, HTML5 world. So they have something called Edge. Adobe Edge is a product that they claim, and I haven't tried it yet. I don't know if this is the case. Will take a Flash animation and turn it into the standard HTML5. Now, it's only in preview right now. It says, create animated web content using HTML, CS5, CSS3, and JavaScript. That's the modern future. And I have to say that I don't think there's much you can do with Flash that you can't do with the more standard HTML5, CSS3, and JavaScript. So what's the difference between that and Flash? Well, Flash is proprietary. It's owned by Adobe. Only Adobe can do it. It has some disadvantages because Adobe hasn't kept their software up to date. It's insecure. It's slow. It doesn't work well with screen readers. Doesn't degrade well in a situation where it's you're on a system that doesn't have the same capabilities as a more modern system. It doesn't handle that well. It just stops working. But HTML5, CSS3, and JavaScript all handle resource-constrained environments much better. They're not proprietary. No one company owns them. They're a standard. So this really is the future. I'm not saying that you should run out and get Edge for your Flash site. This is early. It's in a preview mode. But I guess this is Adobe's idea of how to transition, which is, I think, good for them because... Frankly, Flash was their creation, and a lot of people are stuck with it, and it'd be nice to have a way out. Michael in Riverside, you're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Mike.
Hello, Leo.
Welcome to the show. What can I do for you?
Thank you. I do a lot of voiceovers for international clients as well as United States in several languages, and doing commercials over the internet has proven to be a gold mine, for me at least. My microphone preferences, and I started with an Electro Voice RE20, like the one that you speak into in your studio there.
It's actually not what I'm using in my studio. It was what Chris Marquardt, our photo guy, was using. It's what many radio stations use. Emphatically not what I use.
Okay, that's fine for live broadcasts or and radio stations. The RE20 has proven to be very good from Electro Voice. However, I used to have a D214 Sennheiser, and I'm now using a Neumann, also made in Germany, 105 for vocals, which has proven to be much better than the RE20. if you're talking about doing commercials for that, they are going to be broadcast all over in radio stations as well as TV stations. What is your, what would you recommend as a, because there is a difference. Doing, using a microphone for live broadcast and using a microphone for internet radio. In, over the internet, when you do a live broadcast, like a radio, like a news report, like something like that, a music show, in the internet, those microphones, the RE20 in particular, is not good. It oversaturates, it overmodulates, and sometimes it pops too much.
Yeah, however, you know, I'm going to cut you off here, Michael, because this is kind of a specialized conversation that is really not appropriate for this show, because it's not digital technology. It's actually analog technology. It's how do we take sound waves and turn them into electricity. And that has nothing to do with digital technology. I happen to have some interest in this subject, and I like talking about it because I am a radio personality. I do a lot of voiceover. I'll talk briefly about the difference between some of those microphones and the microphones, some of the other microphones. You mentioned the RE20. I use a PR40, which is the Heil sound microphone, my favorite microphone. You mentioned the Sennheisers and the Neumanns. Those are what we call condenser mics. It's the technology that's used to pick up the audio waves differs. The microphone I'm using now is a large coil diaphragm mic. It's kind of a passive thing. There's no electricity in it. It has a big coil that senses changes in air pressure, in sound pressure, and converts it to electricity. The condenser mics are much smaller. They're tiny little dots, and they have to be powered. You know you have a condenser mic if your microphone requires power. Sometimes they call it phantom power. And there are some characteristic differences between the two. Condenser mics are much more detailed, I think. They're certainly much more sensitive. They tend to pick up. You need a, if you're going to use a condenser mic, you need a soundproof room. You need a much better recording environment than I have. It's one of the reasons I've always used passive microphones, condenser. And many radio stations use diaphragm, big diaphragm mics. Actually, they use both, and I've seen both in recording studios. You might be right that the detail is missing a little bit on a coil, on a diaphragm mic compared to a condenser mic. Although traditionally people have liked the warm, natural sound you get from the kind of mic that I use. I know that in many cases sound engineers will use both kinds depending on what they're recording. So I don't know if there's a right answer, and I'm not a sound engineer, and I'm probably not qualified to have anything more than an opinion on this. But in my opinion, for voiceover, and I do some voiceover, this Heil PR40 is the best mic I've ever used. But that's just for me and for my voice. And I know I'll walk into a lot of studios where they'll have Neumanns or much more expensive microphones that certainly pick up a lot more detail. It kind of depends on your voice, too. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. We were talking about microphones and Jammer B, John Slanina, my studio manager, just brought in this fun microphone that Bob Heil makes with Heil Sound. It's not necessarily the highest quality mic ever, but it is a classic. Look, he designed this for ZZ Top, I think, he told me. It's particularly used by harmonica players who really like it. It's called the Finn, but the reason we like it is it lights up. It does take phantom power, not for the dynamic mic. It doesn't need phantom power, but the lights in the microphone, the blue lights light up. That is so cool. I just love my Finn. Mics are just another fetish, right? I think the reasons people like me get into hobbies like computers, photography, ham radio, is we like the gear. It's just an excuse to go shopping. People say men don't like to shop. Oh, they like to shop. It's just they don't like to shop in shoe stores. We like hardware stores. Mindy San Juan Capistrano, the cavalry has arrived. What's the matter with your computer, Mindy?
Help. Okay. Help me. A few months ago, a friend told me by the symptoms of my laptop that I'd been hijacked. So he walked me through getting malware bytes, Spybot, SMB, and to do these several functions, and it helped. But there is still something living, hidden somewhere, and it seems, I have a little geek in me, so I've tried to do enough troubleshooting to try and understand where the problem might lie. And under task manager,
Wait a minute. Let me just stop you right here.
All right.
There is a misconception that your friend started and you're perpetuating. and you've actually already learned this lesson. The misconception is that once you get malware, you can disinfect.
And instead it should be call Leo first.
Well, no, you can't disinfect it.
Okay.
Every time I say this, I will get 10 or 11 emails from, quote, tech guys. No, you know, I have a computer repair service, and I use malware bytes and a vast antivirus, and I can remove any virus there is and make sure that... Here's the problem, and it's just a problem not of technology. It's a problem of logic.
Okay.
Once your computer has been infested, there is no way of knowing that you've removed all the infections short of erasing the whole thing and reinstalling Windows from a known good source. It's not a technical thing. It's pure logic. The problem being that malware nowadays, bad guys, their entire investment is not in vandalism or mocking you or teasing you. Their entire investment is getting on your computer and using it without your knowledge.
Okay.
So they spend a lot of energy, and these guys are not stupid. They spend a lot of energy on finding ways to hide what they've done. So your friend, he used the traditional tools, and he found some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you know he didn't find everything? Well, in fact, now you do know he didn't find everything.
I do know.
And you want to go back and start doing more of the same, looking at Task Manager, running Rootkit Remover, running SpyBot, even if you use 12 different tools and all 12 say with absolute certainty we can no longer find any infections, there's no way of knowing that.
So I'm making it worse.
You're not making it worse. It's a false it's false sense of security. You have to, and your friends should have done this, and all you tech guys who are going to send me emails, listen carefully. Every security expert agrees. Once malware's on the computer, one of the things malware does is it opens up your system so that other infections can get in. So the fact that you find the infection doesn't mean you found all the infections.
Okay.
You cannot be sure to find all the infections. It's just not possible.
Okay.
So the only thing for you to do at this point, Mindy, is find the disks that came with your computer. Erase the hard. You can back up your data, and there are some techniques to make sure your data is clean. Erase the hard drive and reinstall. Get your system back to the way it was. Run all the updates. Reinstall your apps. Restore your data. There are a few things that you should be aware of. There are theoretical exploits that can actually put a virus, for instance, into your video card. So that even if you do this, it's possible that a bad guy can infest your non-volatile memory in your CMOS or your video card on your master boot record.
What file is qttaskexe? What program is that related to? That one multiplies on my processes list in Task Manager exponentially.
Well,
it just multiplies and multiplies.
Yeah. Okay. So that's your sign that something's wrong.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's a normal Windows process, but what happens is the bad guys take it over, and so I don't know that it's okay.
Okay.
It's QuickTime.
Oh.
But we don't know if it's Apple's QuickTime or bad guy QuickTime.
Sure. Okay.
So I got to say it again. You're barking up the wrong tree. You can say, "Oh, I see this. What if you could? If I could just figure out what this QT task is, I could get rid of that, and everything would be fine." No,
that's where my logic took me.
Yeah, no, I understand that, and that's where your friend's logic took you, and it does seem logical, but doesn't also seem logical what I'm saying, which is bad guys have a huge investment in you not finding them, and they're very sophisticated, and they do rootkits, they do all sorts of, they hide in the video card, they hide in the CMOS, they hide in the master boot record, all sorts of places that you cannot remove or find. In fact, the really, the simple thing a bad guy can do is to piggyback on a system file. And if a bad guy piggy, which almost all of them do, if they piggyback like that, QuickTime perhaps, if they piggyback on a system file, removing the system file breaks your computer. You can't disinfect it. So I hate to say it, Mindy, but okay, I'm going to give you two answers. One,
give me the bad.
Well, if you're willing to take a chance,
I am.
You can uninstall QuickTime and see if this happens.
It's not even on my list. It's not even on my programs list.
Well, there you go. See, this is the problem, is that I can name my malware anything I want, including QTTask. So we don't know. And you could, you know, you could run antiviruses and all that stuff. Did you install, have you ever installed iTunes?
Not since I put in a new hard drive
at
the beginning of the year.
Okay, so probably that is a malware, because you don't have, if you install iTunes, you get QuickTime. But unless you installed iTunes or QuickTime, you probably don't have it, in which case, that's a bad guy pretending to be QuickTime.
Okay.
Right? So,
yes.
I mean, I know it's the biggest pain, it takes the most time, but it's really this is the simple fact, and there's no disputing this. The only way to absolutely be sure is to format the drive and install from a known good source. You can, and this is what these tech guys and your friend are saying, but I'm smarter than the virus guys. I could find everything and get rid of it. And maybe that's true. But can you be sure?
No. Okay. So reinstall Windows.
Yeah.
Or clean everything and reformat.
No, don't even clean everything. Just format the drive, reinstall Windows.
Okay.
You should back up your data, obviously.
Yes, I should.
You don't want to lose
I will.
That. And that you might want to scan, just, you know, make sure there's no data. Usually data does not infect you. You have to have a program to do something bad. The problem is that, you know, some data formats actually are program files, .pif, Word documents, you know, so they can affect you. And it's possible for a bad PDF reader, for instance, to be infected by a PDF file. But data is generally safe. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. This must be the Carbonite song. The guy's calling for backup. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's my phone number. Last segment of the show. Let's see if I get a few people in here, starting with Andy, just up the road a bit in Santa Rosa. Hi, Andy.
Hello, Leo. I was given an iPhone 3GS, and I wanted to back it up before I got to use it, so I have a new PC that I downloaded iTunes to, hooked up the phone, and upon trying to sync it, it went into a mode that now just says, the screen says, iTunes has detected an iPhone in recovery mode. You must restore this iPhone before it can be used with iTunes.
Right.
I'm lost. It's in a loop. I can't get it out. How do I do it?
You have to go into something called DFU mode. There's a couple of different recovery modes for iPhones. And there's the basic one, which you just restore it, use what you're doing, restoring from iTunes. But if that doesn't work, then you have to put your iPhone into DFU, which is Device Firmware Update. It's the hardcore one. If this doesn't work, by the way, nothing you can do.
Okay.
So, it will. It always works.
Okay.
It is tricky because there's timing involved. So I won't walk you through it. It's the timing of holding different buttons on the phone. You have to release the top button and then continue to hold the bottom one for 20 seconds. What's nice is that there are videos online that have the timing exact. So you just, what you do is you watch the video, you follow it, and you release the button when they say to release it.
Okay.
So if you just Google iPhone DFU or iPhone 3GS DFU, this will completely wipe the device. That's what you want, though, right?
Well, I was given it with some stuff on it.
Yeah,
and I wanted to save this.
No,
stuff.
No, it's too late.
It's too late.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, the previous user has it in his backup. You could go back to him after you do the DFU.
Previous user's computer died.
I see. So you're trying to save this phone for this guy?
No, just save the data on the phone to see what's on it.
I see what you're saying. I misunderstood. I thought you wanted to use the phone.
That is going to be true also.
I'll tell you, if you're in a loop on restore, I think you're probably I don't know. I don't know of any way. At that point, I think you really need to DFU it and start over.
Okay.
Chat room, anything, do you have any better ideas? Matt 3 says if you could jailbreak it, you could get out of that loop. But how do you jailbreak it if it's in the loop? I don't understand how you would do that. I think you can't get it to look like a phone anymore, right? It's just restarting, exactly. restarting, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. If you brought it to Apple, they'd just give you a new phone. I think you have to do DFU. That will get the phone back. If the guy can get to his hard drive, he can see those backups. You don't have to be able to boot the system. You just have to be able to see the backup files.
Uh-huh.
And you can move them off of the computer onto another computer and then restore. Let's put it this way. Your chance of success, infinitely better attacking it that way. See if you can get the data off the hard drive on the computer. That phone, you're going to have to DFU it, and at least you'll have a working phone. Somebody's saying, if he puts it in the freezer. No, don't do that. Not recommended. I love my computer. Is that your name?
No.
But it's a pseudonym. That's okay. Yes. We allow pseudonyms on the show. What can I do for you?
I just want to hear your opinions on liquid cooling.
Oh! Well, I'll tell you, liquid cooling is in some ways mainstream these days. So here's the deal. As processors get faster and faster, they get hotter and hotter. And you remember you don't remember, you're obviously too young, but us old folks remember. Remember the old Volkswagen that was air-cooled? The old VW Bug? It was air-cooled because it was like a sewing machine engine. But as engines got bigger and bigger, we had to go to liquid cooling, didn't we? All modern cars have liquid cooling. Well, that's somewhat analogous to CPUs. We air-cool today. But in many cases, for instance, a Cray supercomputer, they had to liquid cool it. In fact, you'll see liquid nitrogen cooling and all sorts of interesting kinds of cooling. It is a hobbyist thing. I don't know of any, maybe chat room does. Apple for a while sold the liquid cooled computer, but I don't think they do anymore. Does anybody sell liquid cooling computers, you know, off the shelf at all? I don't think so. It's an aftermarket thing hobbyists do, often because they want to overclock. They want to get the processor running faster. Corsair sells a really excellent liquid cooling kit that you can add as an after mod. Alienware, thank you, Terry. Apparently the gaming company does sell off-the-shelf, high-end liquid-cooled computers. I think we're still in the air cooling era of computing. Unless you're at a supercomputer or you have very tight quarters where you can't get proper cooling. Liquid cool does do a better job. There's some issues. You don't want to leak. That would be bad. Do I have time for one more? I'm going to try to get one more. Alan is in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hi, Alan.
Hey, Leo.
Thanks for calling.
Hi. So I run a local newspaper in Indianapolis, and we're getting our government is building a parking garage, and I want to put a webcam out that is showing so people can log in to my website and see the progress on the construction. And I have it set up across the street. It's a D-Link 930L, and there's two options. I can FTP the pictures up to my website, which I'm doing,
cool.
And I can email them to myself. So I want a thing where they can go look at the current picture, a static picture, so that gets FTP'd up and overwrites the picture every time, called current, JPEG.
This is the old webcam, man. I did this for years.
Yeah.
Yep.
So the other option that I can go to is I can say also email me a picture every, so many seconds. And so I have it email me a picture so that I can take those pictures and make a time lapse out of it and put that on the website.
That's cool. Yeah.
But it's a lot of work to go to each email then and save off every 5-minute picture all day long to a folder to make a movie file out of it. Is there any way I can have, you know, that current picture that comes up and overwrites itself somehow have that make an archive copy?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Now, this was something very common for a long time. And there was a lot of webcam software out there that would do exactly this. It would save the files off automatically from the FTP, and then you'd have a folder with a ton of them in there. I don't know what the current state is. A lot of these programs are long gone. There was Webcam XP. I'm going to have to search around. But, yes, it can be done. But I'm out of time. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Have a great geek week.